Welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Amy Bloom is one of those authors who, whenever I have a chance to have her on, I jump. She's been on with me three times before for her novels Away in 2007 and Lucky Us in 2014, and her story collection Where the God of Love Hangs Out in 2010. She was on with Barbara for A Blind Man Can See How Much I Love You in 2000, but it has been 11 years since we've talked, and I am way overdue. She's also the author of the novels White Houses and Love Invents Us, as well as the story collection Come to Me, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Her widely acclaimed New York Times bestselling memoir In Love came out in 2022. Amy's short stories have appeared all over the place, including Best American Short Stories and the O. Henry Awards, as well as numerous anthologies here and abroad. She's written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic, on, and has won a National Magazine Award for Fiction. She recently retired from Wesleyan, where she taught creative writing. Her latest is I'll Be Right Here. It spans 80 years and is a kaleidoscopic cast of characters, including a few real-life historical figures that we'll talk about. We follow them from France to Poughkeepsie through unconventional relationships, partnerships, family, unions, and Amy accomplishes all of this within a compact 200 pages. As always, I want to know how she does it. We'll find out today. Amy Bloom, welcome back.
Oh, it's so nice to be here again.
Barely anything has happened in the world or in our lives, so I'm sure we can pick up right where we left off.
Well, we can pick up where we left off and we can sort of take in everything that's around us.
That's a good foundation. You know what I've liked to do lately with writers that I've had on several times before and who have been at this for, you know, more than a minute is to sort of look across all of your work and reflect on it a little bit with the recurring themes, the ways the work has changed over the decades, and just kind of take a minute to see what has endured for you, what maybe has shifted for you, where your areas of concern may have developed into something different and where they have endured. I don't know if you have thoughts about that after all of these novels and collections.
Well, on one hand, I do have thoughts about it, especially for conversations like this, but it's also true that I try very hard not to think about it in my regular writing life. I think if you find yourself as a writer going, let me make sure I address my themes, chances are pretty good you're going to write something fairly tedious.
Yes.
And tedious and preachy and self-admiring and a lot of other things that one wants to avoid. So I think that maybe what I've noticed in my own work is a bit of consciousness to be less showy, to be less clever, right? What the British say, too clever by half.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, you know, that was something that appealed to me. I was a clever kid, and that was useful and self-protective. And I think that some of that probably crept into my early work. And now I'm more ruthless about it, more ruthless about paring it down, more ruthless about not looking for someone to admire the sentence. So I think that's probably a shift. I'm a little better at plotting than I was. I always describe my short stories as being all like sort of French films from the early 1960s in which nothing happens. Somebody enters a room, somebody folds a napkin, somebody leaves the room with a strong look over their shoulder. And that would be the end of the plot for me. I found my outline for a short story that said, woman sees psychoanalyst gets sick, woman falls in love with psychoanalyst's husband in the kitchen, I think. And that is sort of the way I still outline. And the themes haven't changed. The themes were always, as my kids have said to me on more than one occasion, love, sex, death, and family. And those are the only things I write about. And that is true. And probably maybe death has moved up a little bit in the lineup. But those are still the only things I write about.
Which is probably enough, you know. You could
I
fill
feel
some
that way.
books. Yeah, you could fill some books that way. Yeah, it is interesting, I think, as I age and as I talk to writers who age, where the shift of those things does tend to, even if they're writing around the same circle of concerns, the emphasis seems to shift. And I would say that certainly for this novel, that the greats that we're going to talk about in this book, as they age, as they look back, as they see where they have come, you can really sort of see the shift from maybe still sex and relationships, but that shift to death, I think, is exactly right. And I always think that's interesting when I'm following a writer through the arc of their career to watch those things happen.
I guess I would say it's not even so much that writing about death, for example, takes the place of writing about sex. It's also just true that if you're older, you have more to look back on. And,
Yes.
you know, you learn from it or you don't, and you see things that you couldn't or you don't. And so it isn't that I think, oh, one has become more important than the other. It's just that the landscape has shifted a little bit and the horizon is closer, and so you look back over your shoulder and the shadows fall a little differently.
What do you think over the course of it now has made the biggest difference in your writing training? I know that you've practiced as a psychotherapist. I know you've taught. You've written across a bunch of different genres. I don't know if you had training, MFAs and all that kind of formal training as a writer, but I'm curious now to talk to writers about what they feel like was the essential stuff that gave them what they needed, or if it was just kind of woven into their DNA from the beginning.
I had no training at all. I was not an English major. I didn't go to an MFA program. I never had a mentor. And it might have been very different for me if I had had any of those things. But writing for me was such a solitary practice. And I had no advisors and I had no company. You know, I didn't have any writing colleagues, I didn't know any writers. My parents had both been journalists. So, insofar as I had any training or words of advice, it would have been from my dad, who was a working journalist his whole life and a freelance writer. And it was that this is a job. You know, you do the job well and you get paid and you show up every day. And that is the job. And that was very helpful to me.
That's good advice. Yes.
Yes, there was nothing about self-expression or anything else. It was like, is this what you're going to do? It's a job, and your ass is in the chair every day.
Yeah, this is practical advice. Well, let's shift into the book. I'm going to give you a chance to introduce it because you'll do a better job than I sort of tried to do in the intro. So take us in, introduce us to some of these characters, and then we'll talk about them.
Well, the center of the book are these five friends, really. Ghazala and her brother Samir, and Anne and Alma Cohn, who Ghazala meets after she leaves Paris at the end of the war and comes to New York City. And then Honey, who becomes eventually part of the inner circle by marrying Anne Cohn. And at the center of the center is Ghazala. She is the person we begin with and the person that we end with. And we meet her as a young girl in Paris, born of Algerian parents, who becomes the sort of tweeny slash chambermaid slash massage therapist and dog's body to the writer Colette. And that's how we get to know her, and that's how we come to see her through the war. And then she makes her way to America and begins again.
I heard that you got a mandate from your publisher to write a historical novel. And I'm wondering two things. A, if that's true. Maybe I'm wondering three things. A, if that's true. B, if that was sort of the origin story for this, the kernel that got you into it. And let's just start with A and B, and we'll get to C.
Sure, yes, they did want a historical novel from me. And it wasn't as if I had said, oh, no, I can't possibly. I had said, oh, sure. And then I had sort of run through a couple of great candidates for my subject for a historical novel. One of them was Marie Curie, who was a fascinating woman, but also, in the end, after about 6 or 7 months of very intense research, not someone I could identify with or find myself in. She was absolutely brilliant. She seemed to have a lot of trouble being a mother. She had no sense of humor. So somehow that was not for me. Alas, because there it's a fascinating life, and a fascinating person. And then this jewelry designer, Suzanne Bell-Perron, who is a real person who shows up in this novel. I don't know how our paths crossed, but her jewelry was absolutely beautiful and very unconventional and very modern. I did a lot of research about her, but she was not my center either. And then I thought, oh, I need my own person, my fictional person, to enter the world of these women. I also didn't feel like I needed to write a novel about Colette because Colette, honestly, had done such a great job, as did Judith Thurman in her biography of Colette. I thought, oh, there is no need for me to add to this. This is beautifully done already. And so then I had to make my own person who could enter that world. And then I found that I did not want to stay in the distant past. I wanted to bring us through the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, all the way until sort of the early 2000s.
Is it common for your publisher to make demands, is probably too strong of a term, but make strong suggestions of what they want you to do?
No, it's not uncommon. I mean, they're entitled, they're paying me. Nobody is doing anybody a favor in the publishing business, you know.
Right. And so when you made that leap, because I'm wondering about that whole process of deciding we're not going to stay in the 30s and 40s in Paris. We've got to, I've got to get Gazala out of here. And I'm more interested in the whole arc of her life and what she becomes rather than what she is here. At what point did you decide this is going to be a more expansive, multi-generational novel and we're going to get out of Paris?
I guess I was in some ways very much in tune with my character because it was the end of the war, and I sort of felt like she did that I am looking around and going, what next? What do I need to do? And I thought, I need to leave, which was very much also Ghazala. I need to leave and go to this new world and try my hand. And I am a big fan of grit and hustle. And I felt that Ghazala had both those things by the bucket and let us go to this new world where she has the opportunity for reinvention. But one of the things that I found with Ghazala, which surprised me, is that she had no wish to reinvent herself. She is herself all the way through. You know, she tries on a new, cuter, more Parisian, less Algerian name, and she's like saying it was dirt in my mouth. So I went back to my name.
Somebody observed of you, and it's so true that you can get more into a sentence than most people get into an entire novel. And that's one of those lines. I mean, we'll talk about this later, but your ability for compression and painting such a vivid picture so very quickly is so fantastic. But we can talk about that later. But note to self on that line is it's the perfect observation. Just to talk, kind of unpack these real life characters for a moment more. There was another character who wasn't named as a real life character, but who was brought to mind, and I'll totally butcher her name. But Freddie Oversteegen
Yes.
was a figure in World War II who bears a little bit of, I don't know about resemblance to Ghazala, but their method of dealing with resistance felt a little bit familiar. And
Oh,
I assume she was
absolutely.
on your brain. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, she and her sister and their best friend, these three extraordinary Dutch teenagers, were people I had heard about, and then I did some reading, but her existence never disappeared for me, and she was absolutely the inspiration for Ghazala's acts of resistance, because there was something about the combination of the rage and the inclinations of teenage girls and the way in which they were able to attach that to something so important and so much bigger than themselves was just a wonderful moment to write about and a wonderful character to add in for Ghazala.
How deep into these lives of these real life characters do you feel like you need to get? Because I just find research to be a bottomless, delicious pit that I could
absolutely
revel in for decades and do absolutely no work.
Sure.
So how do you know when you've got a sense and you've done enough and, you know, you can leave the real world behind a little bit?
Well, there's a point at which I feel like I could write a brilliant novel about Colette. I could write a brilliant novel about Suzanne Bell-Perron. And then it's time to stop. If that's not what I'm doing, I probably understand what I need to understand. And they were both wonderful characters. And for me, the great discovery about Colette was really her passionate devotion to her third husband. She did something really unusual and I think very emotionally intelligent, which is that having been married to two men in very similar relationships in which they were, you know, the big daddies and she was the adorable, darling, precocious girl sort of flipping her hair and writing furiously, she married a man who was 17 years younger than she was, who had been a, you know, moderately successful, not terribly successful, pearl merchant. And without at all intending to, she overcame her sort of, I think, very conventional Parisian bourgeois anti-Semitism and adored this man and devoted herself to protecting him during World War II, including hiding him all over France and trying to woo the German ambassador and turning her life upside down for love in a way that she had never done before. And so for me, reading about that Colette and her husband, Maurice Goudiquet, was really a wonderful, unexpected rabbit hole to fall down.
It's interesting to hear what unlocked the real life characters for you. You know, that kind of unexpected romance later in her life, which really turns kind of who she is and who she becomes into something different. And I was wondering about that for maybe some of the greats, but certainly Ghazala, what it was about her that unlocked her for you, that made you realize who she was, what made her tick, if there was something she did, something she said that you were like, you know, now I get you.
Well, there were probably a couple of things. I had a great aunt who certainly had some of Ghazala's qualities, including a certain mysteriousness, enormous charm when she chose, and enormous coolness when she did not choose. And there was certainly some of that in how I understood Ghazala. And I think I had always wanted to know more about my great aunt's life, about which she said very little, which was absolutely characteristic of all of my older relatives. I mean, you know, the most you got about life before America was a shrug. You barely got anything about life in America. But that combination of someone capable of enormous depth of attachment, but utterly uninterested in a big circle, you know, very little need to be admired, little need to be talked about, very little need to be liked, but to love and be loved was absolutely at the center.
You know, it's so interesting, the world that this novel is born into versus the world, perhaps, I don't know when you started writing this, but perhaps the world in which the novel was written, because I don't think of you at all as a political writer, but everything in the world has turned political. And,
Absolutely.
you know, this book is very much about immigration and anti-Semitism and queer relationships and, you know, all these things that are now very political. And, you know, I guess the personal has always been a little bit political. So goes the phrase. But, you know, I assume this book is landing in a different climate than the one it was conceived of in, or maybe even the one you intended for it to be received into. And I don't know if you have thought, I'm sure you have thoughts about that. I don't know if you care to share any thoughts about that, about the sort of being the unlikely political writer suddenly.
Well, yes. I mean, I feel like I have always sort of just gone about my business and sort of wrote about things that mattered to me, that occurred to me, that I thought I wished to attempt to put on the page. And that's always been that way. But with this book, as I was finishing it, I mean, I couldn't help but notice that these things that I was writing about, deportation and immigration and the crumbling and polarizing of society. I mean, one of the things that was very striking to me was, you know, when the war ends, Charles de Gaulle does an extraordinary job of rehabilitation of the French sense of self and honor and manages to persuade the French, and I guess the rest of the world, that, you know, most of the French people were in the resistance. That is not how that was. About 2% of the population was in the resistance. And, you know, when I was doing research, and again, this sort of wonderful trove of ephemera of these actual objects from the period, and I am looking at a series of signs that go in the window of a cafe, an actual cafe in France, in Paris, and there are three signs. There is a big sign with a friendly face and drawings of croissants, and it says in German, "Germans welcome, have a croissant." And then there is a smaller sign that says, "We are so sorry, we are out of croissants today." And then there is a medium-sized sign that says, "No Jews ever." And I was very struck by that procession, and it had not seemed to me when I began writing the book that the signs would be so indicative, and that I would then find myself living in a world in which there were signs like that all over the place. And so I don't mind that the book has landed in a more political way. I am not an apolitical person. But I had not thought that the book would land in a time where there were such powerful echoes and so many lessons to be learned about what resistance looks like and what people do and what they don't do and how they understand their own behavior, who leaves and who stays, who fights, who tries to get along. You know, there's a very nice distinction in French between two kinds of collaborators. And so in French, there's a collaborateur and there's a collaborationniste. And it is the difference between people who go along and then people who are active supporters.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think my reading has changed so much in the last couple of years of how I read, you know, it used to be sort of a passive, wasn't that a terrible time? So sorry for them. And now you can't get through a day without asking yourself, what should I be doing? What would they have done? And when you give us little models of what that looks like, inviting a man out into the woods brings it to such clear life in a way that it's a much more interesting time to be reading historical fiction.
Yes, alas, yes.
We should say about the novel that it spans time, but not in a linear way. We're moving around a lot in time in this sort of, I describe the characters as kaleidoscopic, but really the time frame is also kaleidoscopic structurally. And that seems complicated to keep in a writer's brain, organizing this cast of characters, their arcs, there's a generation below the greats. So there's the kind of the matriarchy of, at the high end, and then, they obviously procreate. There's some below them. So it's a big cast of characters and it's a big span of time. And I'm wondering organizationally and structurally if we can kind of unpack how you kept all of that straight for yourself in terms of timelines and character arcs and kind of the look of your office, if it's, Post-it notes everywhere, how you're keeping organized, and maybe talk about, how you arrived at that structure and then how you kept track of it.
I think the structure sort of landed upon me, which is that the structure is really, I mean, partly I had to give myself permission, which is that it's messy. Kaleidoscopic is a lovely term. It's messy, it's non-linear. It is very much like memory. And that is really what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about the way memory is invariably a liar, but there is always truth contained in it. There are a couple of books that I had read, I mean, actually a number, in which the books are very much non-linear and they are messy. And it is not a single story with a single likable protagonist who moves forward through a series of obstacles and triumphs in the end. That is not that book. So I do have a very large bulletin board. And at one end, I'm looking at it right now. At one end is a picture of Colette after the war. She has a small television set. She is in her enormous bed, which she referred to as her raft or her lifeboat. There's a quote by Voltaire, which says, "The adjective is the enemy of the noun." And then
Oh, I like.
at the very far end, there's another quote from Saint Augustine, which says, "I am in a sorry state, for I do not even know what I do not know." And in between were the timelines for each of the characters and who arrives where and when, and also giving myself permission. The table of contents, I hope, is helpful to the reader, but it is also helpful to me, which is basically then, now, always. The things that I really wanted to underline as being through lines for this family, and also wanting to give everybody some space for their own story. And then when we meet, when we encounter the people we will become family with, we are the same and we are also altered because now we have this relationship and that changes us. People are not fixed in stone, not even when they're old. And so, one of the things that was really a great joy for me, for example, is to write about Alma and the chicken farm in New Jersey. There was, in fact, a chicken farm in New Jersey in my life. But to give us a glimpse of the way in which, even though she has never truly connected with her nieces, there is another connection. There is another soul. There is somebody else that she really likes. She likes him. He likes her. They are about, 50 years apart in age, but nevertheless, it is a meeting of kindred spirits. And I wanted to open that door as well, not because it was at the center, it's not part of the theme, but it is the idea that if you choose, you keep opening, right? You open, you close, you open, you close. And that's a decision that some people make. Some people make the decision, nope, I'm set, I'm done. This is as far as it goes. And I don't blame them. There's a great deal in the world that make you want to close and wrap everything around you. But I wanted to sort of look ahead a little bit. I mean, to say, yes, you know what? This lady is in her 80s and she is not done being a person.
You know what it felt like was going through a photo album. And the
Very
flash
much.
goes off on the camera and we're in this scene, and then the flash goes off and we're in this scene. And and who's in the scene changes based on time and relationships and who gets excluded, and we get these little glimpses into things, as you say, that feel like I don't know if it totally hangs on to the tree in a very neat and tidy way, but that is life. That is how memories are made. That is how life is lived. And so it had that photo album experience for me. And I thought, what a fun way to read a novel, but what a nightmare way to have to assemble it.
It is very much a photo album or a kaleidoscope or a collection, absolutely. Because I feel like that is really the way memory is. You know, it turns out that so many of people's, I mean, it turns out in sort of psychological studies that so many of people's memories are wildly inaccurate and terribly important. And I wanted to write about both.
I was wondering as I was reading this, what served you the best? Your short storiness, your gift for the short story, and or your gift for psychotherapy, because both seemed largely at play. Your gift for compression and being able to tell so much in such an economical amount of space, and the psychological insights of exactly how memory works and how characters develop and in a non-linear way. All of that seemed to culminate in this book. It was great.
Oh, I'm so glad. I think that they did come together. I mean, I always, when I was younger and people would say, well, how has being a psychotherapist affected your work? I was always, I have to say, sort of faintly offended, as if somehow my writing ability had not just sort of popped up like an enormous hibiscus, you know, with no need for anything else. But I also think I became a psychotherapist because this is the stuff that's interesting to me. There are only two things that really matter to me. One is love, and the other one is language. And that led me to becoming a psychotherapist, and it led me to becoming a writer. And so it is true that having been a psychotherapist for now, I'm shocked to say, 45 years, I have observed a few things about human beings. It doesn't necessarily help, but I have observed a few things. But that wasn't really what pushed me towards writing, sort of. This family album, as you call it, it was really just being willing to sort of enter into these different souls. And I didn't have to stand apart from them and look at them or study them. I had to be them, which is not how psychotherapy works.
Well, to that point or that question, who gave you the fits of who was the most difficult to enter? I'm really interested in this idea of spending all of this time with Madame Curie and then being like, I just, you're a bridge too far for whatever reason. But I imagine in a cast of characters like this, there would be somebody who is a tough nut to crack. And I was wondering who you struggled with and how you managed to wrangle them in.
I think for me, what happens as a writer is that the struggle, what a surprise, is not really ever about the other person. It's not really about the character. It's always about me. It's always, what am I willing to experience? What am I willing to say? Do I want to look at that? Oh, I'd really rather not, you know? And sometimes, you know, like with Marie Curie, I was like, I really admired so many things about her, but probably including the fact that she was a scientist. I am not. I don't really even have those inclinations. Just a combination of things I was like, I don't think I can do this person justice. I think there are characters who are quite different than I am, like Honey, who I just love as a character. I just love her. She has so many qualities that I really like and enjoy and admire. I think we would have been very good friends. I don't know that we are so much alike, although I do identify with and really enjoy her determination to be who she is. But her, I had to sort of come at it a slightly different way. I think Lily, who is Honey's stepdaughter, was also kind of a cool customer and not built like me. So I have to sort of imagine how she had come to be who she was and what she had and what she didn't have. But again, you have to, I had to, as a writer, let myself be this, you know, cool-eyed, tall, pretty, commanding blonde who seemed to have a chip of ice in her heart. And how did that chip get there? And what melts it? You know, so you got to be prepared to experience yourself in ways that are not flattering, not charming, you know.
Does this bulletin board contain pictures of Honey and Lily and these other characters so that you have a visual sense of them in mind? Are you a visual writer?
I think I am quite a visual writer, but there are images. I mean, I could describe them in great length, but the images are entirely interior to me. I don't look in a magazine and go, oh, that's sort of what Honey looks like. I mean, I know sort of what Honey looks like, and I know what Anne and Alma look like. I mean, I know what everybody looks like, but that's because, you know, they exist in the little cinema of my head.
I've always thought of you, and I don't know if this is a fair description. I've always thought of your writing as sort of you're like a feminine feminist, and strong, wonderfully strong women, but feminine women, sexual women, and the play of different kinds of relationships, and it felt like you were setting this wonderful buffet table here. Kind of literally and figuratively. I mean, we haven't even talked about the massive amounts of food and lovely food descriptions in the book, but also sort of a love, if food is a metaphor for love and a love of all forms, love of every form and sexual relationships of all forms and every form. It was just this beautiful buffet table that was set out for us. And that strikes me as a very feminist idea. And, some of this takes place in the 70s with these, feminist consciousness raising groups and things. Am I getting that right? Do you feel like that's an apt description of these characters and of this setting?
Well, I certainly think it would surprise me if somebody read any of my work about anything and were like, oh, I see that you are definitely not a feminist. That would really surprise me. I mean, I feel like for me, being a feminist is like breathing. You know, I was like, I don't mean it's at the core of my personality, but it's certainly, I never give it a second thought. I didn't give it a second thought even when I was a kid. I remember watching my parents have a fight about something very small in the house, and my father didn't want to do it, and my mother wanted to, but my mother was, as they say, in the late 50s, a homemaker. And that was the end of the conversation because she didn't have her own money. And I remember watching from the kitchen. My sister and I were both huddled in the kitchen watching this fight between my parents. And I think our eyes met. She is quite a bit older than I am. And I could see that we were both thinking, not for me, thank you. Which is certainly part, not the only part of feminism, but certainly part of feminism. And I guess for the feminine part, I don't know that it's necessarily feminine, but I do really like being a whole person. I do really like, you know, being a mother. I do really like lots of things, I guess, that people think of as feminine. And they are also, to me, I mean, the thing about cooking is that it's not only a way of nurturing, but it also requires industry and focus. And knowing what you want, you know? I mean, you know, there's all sorts of different kinds of feeding. I mean, I remember when I had a full-time job and three kids at home, and the entire function of cooking was to be able to feed five people in less than 25 minutes. And I am glad I mastered that. It's not my favorite kind of cooking, but to this day, I can do it. So for me, there's also that kind of cooking where you are focused on keeping everybody going, which is very different than, you know, the frills and the prosciutto beautifully draped over the figs, which I also like.
The practical and the artful, all necessary parts of, I guess, being a human, but yeah, particularly being a woman. We'll be back with more from Amy Bloom talking about I'll Be Right Here in just a moment. You're listening to Writers on Writing. If you haven't yet done so or you're new to the podcast, I'd love to invite you onto our Patreon page. If you're enjoying the show, you've learned any tips that have inched you closer to publication, or you just enjoy these behind-the-scenes discussions of how these books get done, this is your chance to support the show. Any amount helps us out. You can visit patreon.com/writersonwriting. If you're interested in purchasing a copy of Amy's book or any of the books from our past guests, consider doing that on bookshop.org. Your book dollars go to supporting independent bookstores. A little goes to helping the show out. You can shop at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting. And if you're so inclined to drop us a review, however you consume your podcasts on Apple, Spotify, drop us a review. That helps the show out, and we really appreciate it. Let's get back to it with Amy Bloom talking about I'll Be Right Here. So I wanted to talk about some of the delightful writerly things that you do in this book that I think we all can learn from as writers. And one of them is lists. I went back to look for this chapter when this first occurred to me. There's a wonderful chapter early on in the book that when I went back to look for it, it didn't come straight to me. But it's this wonderful chapter of lists of, I believe, all the things Ghazala is just looking at around
everything
her.
She can see from her deathbed.
Yes, yes.
Right. I think the chapter is called Thank You So Much.
Yes, that's right.
It's everything that she can see.
But that's a technique you used quite a bit it still feels like that came early on in the book. And then once I noticed it, I began looking for it, and it's a wonderful device isn't really the right word, but a wonderful technique I think writers can use to get so much from their characters, especially maybe when they're stuck, you know, in a block situation, just starting to make lists. But tell me a little bit about your use of lists and love of lists, because they're so effective in here.
Thank you. I think the big thing about the list of things, whatever it is that the point is not to signify to your reader. I just finished reading a book which started strong and ended not so strong. And there were all of these sort of nudging and winking to the reader, you know, a person who likes this. And first of all, because so many of the references were sort of pop culture, they just sort of come and go. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with it. But if the wish is to connect with your reader through the list, I think the lists tend to be very flimsy and sort of doomed in their intention. Especially if you think anybody will be reading them 5 years after they're published.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the list, it comes from inside the character. It's just the way the character, I'm sitting here looking out my window at the harbor, and it's like, I could describe a bunch of things I see in the harbor, but the only thing that really gives them meaning, aside from some pretty writing, is what they mean to the person who is seeing them. That's their meaning. The meaning in Ghazala's list is things that have mattered to her, relationships that have mattered to her, things that she notices and how she writes about them. So she writes about, for example, the little bowl that holds her bobby pins. And my point was not to signal to the reader, hey, this is a woman who needs bobby pins, i.e. her hair is longer than ear length. The point was, it's how she feels about it. And what she feels about it is not a lot. It was made for her by the daughter of one of her favorite saleswomen at the small department store that she and her brother ran. But it's just that she is looking. Oh, there's the lumpy little ceramic bowl. Oh, there is that salt and pepper shaker. Oh, I remember when I threw it on the ground, I was so angry at that man. And then at the last minute, I pulled back from smashing it, which I guess was the right thing to do. Maybe it's what one does. You know, maybe there is not that much difference between kindness and losing your nerve. But that is about her. It's not to signal to the reader, hey, this is the kind of eccentric old lady who likes salt and pepper shakers. You know what I mean. It's not a shorthand. It's not a way to get the reader to see something that you otherwise cannot convey.
And as you are writing the list, are you learning that information in real time by making the list yourself?
Sometimes I am looking at the things and I can hear. I cannot write without hearing the characters' voices. If I don't hear them, everything is stillborn. I mean, it doesn't matter how good the sentence is, things are just not alive. And so I could sit in the room and look at the object, which is what I was doing. I was looking at a bunch of objects which belong to me. But when I see them as Ghazala, they are quite different. They are actually not my feelings about the objects at all. And they're not my memories about the objects, they are hers. I've just provided a sort of array of things, but the meaning of the things is how the character perceives them.
And are you writing this straight through, or are you writing in fragments? Because some of these chapters are so short, you could think of them as little standalone fragment jewels. And I
Absolutely.
was, are you writing them that way, or are you writing in the order that the book now appears, or yeah, tell me about that.
Wouldn't say I write in the order in which they appear. I mean, some pieces, go all the way, but even the pieces that go all the way through. I mean, I wrote the scenes which open the novel. There are two scenes that open the novel. One is the sisters at Ghazala's deathbed, which I wrote almost at the end of the book, and also Ghazala as a 2-year-old playing in the courtyard, which I also wrote at the end of the book. So, sort of they show up when they show up, and our job is to keep track of them and give them all the space that they need and all the language that they need. And then for me, I can figure out where they go. And because this book was sort of assertively nonlinear, I could sort of see where does this go? It was very hard to figure out Honey in Northampton in the 70s. Is that going to be her, and in the novel, it's sort of her memory of her life as well. And that's one of the real nice things about writing about all these old people, which is that they have these long tapestries of memory. And you can go in and then you can leave it and come back to the actual present. And you can also return to the past, because that's part of what it means to have a long past that unspools behind you. And we don't live there. We go to the grocery store, we work, we write, we do things, all of which are very much in the present. But the past is also available, to dip into and come out of. And sometimes you come out of it with a little more something, forgiveness, anger, regret, affection. And sometimes not so much.
Yeah, it's so great to start with this deathbed scene, which is just a couple of pages, because it sets the stage for we are at the end, and the rest of the next 200 pages are going to be us dipping back into all of these things. But the anchor is this deathbed scene, so that we are given permission to go to all of these different places over history. What a great way to set that up, and something that would have never occurred to me.
Well, I was desperate.
Necessity is the mother of invention, whatever. Yeah.
Sometimes, yes.
The other thing that I wanted to point out to writers is your use of I guess every writer uses everything in their toolkit, but there's a lot of really interesting things in your toolkit here. So some of these chapters are written sort of like a play. Some of these chapters have, there's a lot of really interesting things that you do with quotation marks, where you either use them, you don't use them, you mostly don't use them. I think writers don't always look at the entirety of their keyboard. They see those 26 letters and that's what they use, but there's a lot of really interesting things that you can do with form and style and punctuation. And what I really appreciated about this from a writing perspective is how much play you allowed yourself. This chapter of lists, as we talked about. I can't remember if there were little letters to anybody in here, but
Well,
there's.
there's a very long letter which is from Samir to Ghazala, which
Oh,
is
yes, right. Yeah, right.
a pivotal thing in the book, because she does not receive the letter right after he writes it. And
Right.
it is the thing for me, because Samir, who I find to be a very attractive character, I mean, I feel like I write Samir with a lot of love, but he is described repeatedly by various people in the family as sort of unknowable, mysterious, the one that you want to draw in, the one whose attention you seek. And the thing that tells us what we did not get to see about Samir is in that letter. And that was also actually a very political letter.
Yeah.
You know, it is about the massacre of Algerians after Algerians have helped France win the war, and France repays them by massacring thousands. And I wanted us to see Samir in his own voice, which we only get to do on occasion. But I wanted to sort of do that excavation. I wanted to reveal that. So I do. I mean, I like the epistolary in general, and I like the different ways in which people can reveal themselves, in which we can see who somebody is or somebody was. And in some ways, it's the same thing. The play is very, very brief. It's just Lily remembering these scenes with her ex-husband. You know, she's not telling Ghazal. She's sitting by Ghazala's deathbed, and she is remembering herself what those scenes looked like. And I feel that that is something that can happen in memory, which you can actually stand back and see the scene as it was for you then or as it is for you now looking back. But there are moments where we see the scene in our own lives, and I wanted to have that. And with the quotation marks, mostly what it indicates is when they disappear, it's just that somebody has moved from conversation to interior monologue, which I think happens a great deal, especially with people who are older. What you say, and there's what you think.
People should remove the quotation marks in their own life more often. Yeah.
Agree.
Yeah, there are so many interesting, you know, I mean, between your play in across the body of your work, from the short stories to novels to, of course, the memoir, you have a nonfiction book out. I think you write children's books.
Mm-hmm.
I think I heard you're writing now mystery coming up. So
I do. I have a mystery. I'm very keen about it. I have a mystery coming out next spring, next May.
Fantastic.
And it was really set. It was set at Wesleyan University, which is now called Cromwell University. And it was really, it was just a lot of fun to write about a disgraced English professor turned private investigator, and the unlikable professor who was bludgeoned to death with a bronze bust of Nathaniel Hawthorne, and he had it coming. So it was a great deal of fun.
I love, you know, as we were talking about continuously reinventing yourself all the way through and not becoming kind of static and calcified. I love watching this in writers where they're like, now I'm going to try this. And now I'm, you know, I know you've talked about the memoir being sort of more of a mandate than a desire, but, you know, that you're flexible to try all of these different forms and ideas, and in this book and in your work in general. I think that's really fun.
I do too. And I think, you know, you have to give yourself a chance. And I think always, 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 you have to be willing to fail. Okay. I don't want to write the same book over and over again. I would prefer to make mistakes. And since making mistakes is absolutely guaranteed, was that great line from Randall Jarrell. He said, "What is a novel? It's a piece of prose that has something wrong with it." And that's okay. You know, you do not get to ice skate without falling on your ass. And I feel the same way about writing. You don't get to do this without making mistakes, without embarrassing yourself, without writing things that you might look back at later and go, ah. I had this experience actually not this long ago. I was turning in an essay for a magazine, and they had sent me some, you know, tiny little editorial changes. And I'm looking at it and I'm going, what is this sentence? This is trash. And I'm about to blame my poor, completely blameless editor when I realized, no, Amy, you wrote that crappy sentence. Somebody else didn't write that crappy sentence. You did, and it got through the net, and now you got to fix it. But you're going to write crappy sentences. You're going to have bad ideas. You're going to go out on a limb, and the limb is going to crack, and you're going to land on the ground. And I think, to me, if you are not prepared to do that, you probably should take up something more reliable.
Well, and I know you're such a passionate reviser. We haven't talked that much about revision. Maybe we can end on advice you have for revision. You have a great essay. I mean, it's now 11 years old. I think it came out in Granta about revision. But yes, you're a passionate reviser. I think you said if you had to choose between coffee and revision, you'd choose revision.
Those are quite as strong as a
Yes,
statement,
that's a
but I
strong
think
statement. Yeah.
it's true. I think it's such a great opportunity. I remember teaching, and I would give some prompt in class, and there'd be a couple of clever kids who would have finished, and they put down their pens and they look around expectantly, as if we're all still in eighth grade and you get points for being the first.
Right.
I'm like, no one gives a shit how fast this is. Is it the best sentence you can write right now? That's not the best sentence you can write. Why are you not fixing it? You
Yes.
know,
Yes.
the point is not, to have that big flurry of satisfaction at the very beginning. I think often, what one feels at the beginning is that you've, had a bout of the flu, and then you make it better. Because you have the skills to make it better, and you have an obligation to serve the work. The point is not for it to be a nice experience or a experience in which you can stand there and admire yourself for having written it. The point is to serve the story, to serve the people you've made up, and to make it as good as you possibly can, even if it takes longer, even if it makes you feel bad.
And do you have an internal governor to know when that process is done? Because obviously, like for this essay you're talking about, you must have released it off. Do you know when you? I mean, I assume that this is, having been at it for some period of years, you get a better and better sense for it. But do you now have a pretty strong sense of when it's time to let it go?
Yes, and some of that also depends on the circumstances. This was not in my mind, nor in the mind of the publication, a major essay. It was a short thing, it was informal. And so I wasn't paying it as much of attention as I should have been because I was in the middle of doing other things. And that doesn't happen to me very often. I usually am able to sort of sit down, and when I turn something in, especially when I turn in a piece of fiction, I have edited it as hard as I can. I don't expect my editor to fix it.
Yeah.
I'm happy to hear what my editor has to say, but if I haven't done that work, I'm not turning it into anybody. That's my baby. I'm
Yep.
not, and I think in the modern world, turning it over to your editor and expecting it to be improved in the way that you would have chosen to improve it. There's a little bit of a misunderstanding of what's going to happen.
This is why the New Yorker, whoever it was that said that you bring more to a sentence than most people bring to a whole book, gets done. It's through the, I mean, it's through this art of compression and revise, 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 and then you get these sentences that, just blow people away. So the work
Bingo.
pays off.
It does pay off most of the time.
Amy Bloom, I don't know why I waited 11 years. This was just so much fun. So I'm so glad we got to do this.
Oh, I am glad too. And it's always nice to talk to you about writing and writers.
You too. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Amy Bloom. The book is I'll Be Right Here. It's out and available now, published by Random House. In addition to our Patreon page, you can always visit our websites. The show's website is writersonwriting.com. It's got an archive of all of our past shows. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is Marie Stone, two R's and Marie.com. You can always subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, however you consume your podcasts. As always, our fantastic music and sound design was provided by Travis Barrett. You can find more typewriter music on Spotify under Just My Type. That's all the time we have for today. Tune in next week. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.